Amen. All right, we are on a servant, a disciple's greatness. So going through the attributes of discipleship, and we're going to be starting in Matthew 20 today, if you want to turn over there, and I'll get somebody to read from there in just a moment. This is one of the unintuitive things that Christ preached, something that kind of goes against our natural thinking. You know, when he preaches to love your enemy, that goes against our natural thinking. When he preaches that the way to be greatest is to be least, that goes against our natural thinking. And he addressed this multiple times, but in this particular case in Matthew 20, he's being approached by the mother of James and John. And of course, James and John were described as sons of thunder, and so they were an energetic, brash couple of guys that Jesus picked to be a couple of his apostles. So who can read Matthew 20, verse 20 through 28, that whole section?
All right, where do you want to start?
20 through 28. So there's several interesting things in that section. One of them is that Jesus says it's not his to give. The word there is basically said, but it's an authoritative kind of said. In some translations, it's grant. In other translations, it's command. And he says it's not for me. It's not the kingdom of Jesus. It's the kingdom of God. And so the Father is the one that makes that call. But much as we are predestined, and the way in which we're predestined is that the ones that are able to get there are the ones that follow the pattern, he says, if you want to be great, here's the pattern you follow. It's God the Father's call, but God the Father's already defined how you get there, and here's the pattern that you have to follow. So he compares it to the way in which the people around them were considered great at the time. So when he says that great amongst the Gentiles, you know, the rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them, who's he talking about, the rulers of the Gentiles? Like, who would they have encountered? You got the rulers of the, you got Caesar. He's a ruler of the Gentiles, but none of them had ever met Caesar. So in their day-to-day life, who were the rulers of the Gentiles? Yeah, you had the local governor. Who else? Yeah, your pilots, and the military leaders, the centurions. You know, it was a military occupation, right? That's how Rome ruled, was a military occupation. And so any place of any significant population at all had military garrisons there. You know, smaller places had less, bigger places had more. But there are numerous times that Jesus came upon centurions. Well, what's a centurion? It's a military commander of 100 guys. So in that place, when he comes across a centurion, there are 100 military people there just keeping order, keeping rule. What did Jesus say to the soldiers when the soldiers asked him how they should behave? I can't give you all the questions in Facebook because sometimes I think of them on the fly. Do y'all remember that? He was going and different people were coming to him. They were saying, well, what should we do? And he would tell them. And then the tax collectors would say, well, what should we do? Well, you shouldn't take more than blah, blah, blah. And the soldiers said, what shall we do? And he told them not to abuse their power, basically. And so that was the standard. The standard was that the Gentile lords ruled it over them. They abused their power. They went even further than they had the direct authority to do, and the direct authority they'd been given them was probably already too far before they even took it further. So he said, that's not how this is going to be. You're not going to end up being an elder and then you're going to rule with an iron fist. You're not going to end up being an apostle and you're going to live a luxurious life because you're overtaxing everyone that's around you and things like that. That's not how the kingdom is, and that's not how to become great in the kingdom. So when we think about greatness in our society, we can think about people who are rich or people who are high up in politics or people who excel in a craft, be it the arts or sports or things like that. I wanted to use sports as an example because I thought it was maybe a little bit more quantifiable. What makes somebody considered great in a sport in our society?
Winning.
If you're a quarterback, winning. Okay. We can't get too deep into the football. I don't know it. A comparison to others, in comparison to those you're competing against, at your level, right? And it is at your level. Like you go and you're like, look at this high school quarterback. He's amazing. Let's put him on the 49ers. No, that's a horrible idea. The poor kid would die, right? That's not how it works. And so when we get to the pinnacle of greatness, it's about winning, but it's about beating everybody else, right? You're getting to the point that not only have you excelled at high school and college and at the professional level, but now you've beaten all the professionals too, right? There are plenty of golfers out there that are fantastically great and would destroy us every single time that have never made it into the top 10 and that most of the world hadn't heard their name. And tons of people have heard names like Tiger Woods. I don't want to embarrass myself for trying to list golfers. But everyone knows Tiger Woods.
Jack Nicklaus.
I know, I was going to say Nicholson, and that's the Joker. And that's not right. So that was the one I was thinking of. I'm like, duh, you're going to say it wrong. But we know them because they got to a higher level, right? They got to the top. They got so good at what they were doing and so great at what they were doing that people knew them outside of people that actually cared about what they were doing. So, how do we measure that? Okay, Tiger Woods was great. Well, he was great because he won. So we could measure by win percentage. But that's not the only way we measure. How else do we measure?
How much money they get?
Earnings? The effort they put in? I don't think we do. I don't think we measure it by their effort. You put in tons of effort, and if you haven't made the accomplishments, people don't seem to care. Sports are so statistic driven right now. We're sitting there looking at positively everything these people are doing. It's like, look how great Tiger Woods is, and somebody will go into the numbers and they'll be like, he gets within, there's so much math, it's crazy. People call me a nerd, and I'm like, you guys nerd out on math so much, fantasy football people and stuff. You go and you look at all these numbers, and they're tracking the greatness, and they're saying, look at this guy's, you know, slugging in baseball. Look at his slugging. And then they go, well, that's not really a good measure. Because if you've got really good slugging, but you don't have really good on-base percentage, then it doesn't matter. What really matters is, you know, your on-base percentage and then how you're driving home runs. So they come up with a brand new way to measure it, on-base plus slugging. And they go, that's the maximum way to measure offense. And then they come back later and, you know, someone like Mark McGuire, I'll say, well, really, all that matters is runs. Why are you measuring anything else? It's just whether you get runs. That's how we look at it. We're sitting there measuring it like crazy. Well, these brothers had come with their mom. And he says, you're looking at it all wrong. The way that you become great is by being a servant. So I didn't ask how someone becomes great at a sport. I think that gets back to the effort, right? I think that gets back to the amount of time you spend, how you train, who you're around, having people around you that are good at it or that know about it to help guide you. How do you how does becoming a servant make you great?
Well, because you're putting him other people first, not yourself.
How does that make you great?
It satisfies the standard that God has established.
Okay, it satisfies the standard that God has established. Makes you more like God, more like Christ.
Well, who makes you more great according to who? Men or God?
Right.
That's what the question for men or God.
Well, and that's part of it, right? The thing that makes you great is rooted in the fact that we are measuring like God measures. And so then that's the follow-up question is, well, how is it measured? So you're looking at yourself. And you say, all right, I am a servant. I'm trying to imitate Christ. I want to get better. I want to be a better imitator of Christ. How do you measure that? How do you know if you're getting better? How do you know if you're maturing? So one way is to keep looking at the measuring stick. If you're going to try to figure out if you're this far along and you're just going to try to remember how long that yardstick was when you go over and start cutting the fabric or whatever, that's not a good idea. Keep the measuring stick with you. Reference it so that you know. How else? Yeah. Yeah, it is a type of standard we're not accustomed to. And I think what Jesus meant when he goes, are you able to drink the cup? And they said, we are able. And he said, you're going to drink it. I think the point that he was making there was, I'm about to drink the cup. Right? He's coming up on the crucifixion and everything. I'm about to drink the cup. You're not going to be ready to drink it then. But later in life, you're going to get to a level where you'll be ready to drink that cup. Yeah. Yeah, Jesus' confidence in his apostles is encouraging. He, because I mean, Peter was such a defiant person. Like, you know, continually, even when they're letting the sheet down with all the animals, it's like, God says, eat. He's like, no, God just told you to do something. Do it. I'm interested in the concept of measuring because if we don't measure, it's easy to get either off track or to not be making progress. So what Debbie and Laura were saying about you've got to do and you've got to not do as you are brought with temptations and trials is correct. And I don't know that it's necessarily helpful to keep a scorecard or something like that. I don't think that's a good idea. Where you're like, all right, I was tempted 30 times in November and I only sinned 8. Let's do better in December. I don't think that's helpful. But there has to be some way that you're looking at yourself and that you're evaluating yourself. Because you look at what Paul said. He said, hey, you guys haven't grown. By this time, you should have been ready for meat, but you're not ready for meat. I still have to teach you the rudiments. Okay. Well, I like to think I had the rudiments down pretty good by the time I was in my early 20s. I like to think that I was able to eat meat by the time I got to my, you know, into my early 30s. But that's not the end, right? I have to keep growing in the Word. I have to keep progressing. I certainly don't live a sinless life. I have to continue working on battling my weaknesses and battling my sins. But I worry if we think, you know, if we're not measuring it somehow, that we're not going to realize we're not growing.
I think that's what the whole concept of elders, for example. You need a special kind of man, thanks to experience and time growth, but you need a special kind of man as well, which are the characteristics, qualifications that are given in that text. Because some people get older and they really don't, you know, they don't increase. But so maybe one of the things would be to quantify the things that make for a special Christian, one who really, really growing stronger and try to incorporate those things.
It's hard.
It's hard to set the standard, but in some ways, I mean, for example, the qualifications of the elders, able to convict the gainsayer, take study, but slow to anger, slow to wrath, that's something that has to do with the personality, and yet it is something that is changeable as well. You become more gentle and more long-suffering as time goes on, but it's not just just knowledge. It's incorporating those things that God expects of you and changing your character. So maybe the adding of the fruit of the Spirit, the Christian graces that are mentioned in 2 Peter chapter 1, you're going to be more and more servant-like as you add the attributes that God said these are the things that make you a better person, more Christian person.
Yeah, and it's not really that the Bible is a measuring stick that we measure ourselves against. The Bible is a whole host of measuring sticks that we measure ourselves against, and we measure ourselves against love, and we measure ourselves against mercy, and we measure ourselves against patience, and we measure ourselves. And I think that's an important part of it. We've talked before, you know, there are people that have taken things to extreme. They're like, well, I'm going to focus on study. And they focus on study so much that they exclude other aspects of being a Christian. And at the end of the day, they're not a good Christian. They're a good studier. And they may know a lot about the Word, but they're not a good servant. You know, you think about a servant in the physical sense back in Jesus' time. If a servant, you know, you think about the people with the talents, right? They hand out the 5 talents, the 2 talents, 1 talent. And if you go to the 5-talent guy, he goes, hey, look, I got 5 more talents. Good job. You get to the 2-talent guy, and he's like, well, I've been studying it, and I've been looking at this, and I think that if we invest over here, and I think if we buy that and sell this, and I think, and the master's like, I've been gone 3 months. Have you done anything? Well, no, I still just had the 2 talents. I haven't done anything with them yet, but I've been studying, and he's not going to be happy with that person. Nor is he going to be happy with the person that just starts doing with the 2 talents immediately with no thought and no study and ends up losing it all. He's not going to be happy with either of those people. So we have to look at ourselves. We have to examine ourselves. We have to measure ourselves in multiple ways, so that we are balanced and so that we are complete. Unique role for a servant. So, he says at the end of the second paragraph that Jesus taught that the greatest thing we can hope to be is servants to our brethren. And that's the context he's talking about here. We're supposed to be servants in general. Like, Paul said he's a servant to everybody, right? If he was only a servant to brethren, he wouldn't have had to go off and start all these new congregations. He's a servant to every human on the earth, because every human on the earth is someone for whom Christ died. Disciples of Christ are servants of Christ, but ultimately servants of the Father. And Jesus goes on to say that it was not his to give. Not his to give. So what does it mean to be greatest in the kingdom? What do you have when you're greatest in the kingdom? If I'm greatest in the kingdom of Rome, I have the throne, right? I'm the king, I'm Caesar. What does it mean to be the greatest in the kingdom? What do you have?
Well, it's an interesting thing when Jesus compared John the Baptist to the least in the kingdom, that the least in the kingdom is greater than he, so it had reference to a reward that is a part of that relationship coming there, that in the new covenant is better than what John never experienced that got to, so the greatest. So I think that when you want to measure greatest with regard to service, it doesn't have to do with anything with regard to meriting or getting where you can stand by someone else and say, look at me, I'm doing better than you are. It's just the more active and capable you are, it just ensures you're standing with God. So the greatest would have heaven, but that doesn't mean he's the only one. Anything. So in order to be greatest, it just basically means it's a service. You have to be the best servant. How do you quantify that?
Yeah. I think that you end up getting a lot of benefits that, again, are counterintuitive to what people think about the benefits of greatness being. But if you are greatest in the kingdom, then you have achieved a level of peace and a level of love and a level of these kind of attributes of yourself, that if you have them and you are understanding them and appreciating them like you should, are going to be so valuable that you're not going to want to give them up. And if you do give them up, if you start being less of a servant, if you start being less like Christ, and you lose the peace and you lose the love and you lose those types of things, the absence and the void that you feel there is overwhelming. You know, I forgot to get back to something that he said a second ago. It is interesting that the world will measure us. We've said that before, where if you're not suffering or if you're not being persecuted, that's the world telling you you're not the peculiar person you're supposed to be. You're not the shining light. You're not the imitation of Christ that you're supposed to be, because the world will recognize that and they will measure you. And they measure you against what? Themselves. And you aren't like them. Why should a disciple be a servant? I said that in my post on Facebook, I said that the author, I think, missed the point a little bit here, and we've been touching on it a little bit. But I do want to get into the why, because he asks a good question. So he says, why be a servant? So you can be greatest in the kingdom. Well, is that your motivation, really? My motivation is to be greatest in the kingdom? I don't think that is your motivation. I think that's a byproduct. The greatest servant is the greatest in the kingdom, but they weren't, I'm going to be the greatest servant so I can be greatest in the kingdom. That wasn't their motivation. And then, why should you be a servant? To follow Christ's example. Yes, and that's how you be the greatest, by following Christ's example. But something that I would encourage everyone to do is that when they look at a command in the Bible, to think about the why. Because under each command in the Bible is a why. There's a reason that God has that command. And there are plenty of commands that I obeyed for years of my earthly father that I didn't see any value in. And then when I got later in life and more experienced, I went, oh, that's why I should do that. Or cases where I didn't follow what my dad said and everything seemed fine. And then 10 years down the road, everything was not fine, because he had the experience and the knowledge to know where it should go. You can see that with the Word of God, too. You're not going to know all the whys the first time you get it, but you should be striving to figure out why you've been given commands, because the principle behind why God has this rule can guide you in other decisions and aspects of your life. So God says marriage is one man, one woman for a lifetime. Divorce is not supposed to be a thing. Okay, why? Or it says to love your enemy. Okay, why? I'm building that up. So I think that's the question here that would be helpful for us. Okay, to be greatest in the kingdom, be a servant. Why should a disciple be a servant? What is the benefit to you of being a servant? What's the benefit to the kingdom of being a servant? What's the bad thing that happens if you aren't a servant?
Well, others outside of the kingdom, outside of the church, can see your servitude, and of course that would be a good example for them.
So we're an example to the world of the benefits of service. It is important, you know, when people look at the church, They should see something that's desirable to be a part of. And if we are imitating Christ, it will be a desirable thing to be a part of. What else? What are the benefits to you by being a servant?
Well, you serve someone, they serve a lot of them serve you. You get a lot of service too.
So you've got that web. You're bearing one another's burdens. It's a mutual benefit. What were you saying, Laura? So Laura said about it helps you be in the right mindset towards God with humility, and what you're saying, it helps you be in the right mindset about what's important. I mean, it's one of those interesting things, it's better to give than receive kind of thing, right? And there are a lot of people that never come to agreement with that sentiment. But if you can let the service help you have that right attitude, it can guide you towards that peace and that benefit of love that we were talking about a moment ago. You know, sometimes we talk about if you're tempted to sin, then pray. Hard to sin while you're actively praying to God, right? You're tempted to sin, read your Bible. Hard to sin while you're actively reading your Bible. There are things about service that's true too. Hard to sin when you're actively teaching someone about the Bible. Hard to sin when you're actively engaged with somebody, serving them and helping them with a need they have. The greatest commandments are to love God and to love your neighbor. If you're spending your time in service, it's going to help you have a love-centered life. I never know how many times to hit next on these. How to be a good servant. All right, he's got several sections in here. The first one is attitude. What does service in the church look like with the wrong attitude? I'm not talking about having the wrong attitude and so you don't serve. I'm talking about people who are serving, but they're serving with the wrong attitude. What does that look like? It could be you have an attitude of pride, an attitude of self-praise, not praise of God, not letting God have the glory. Yeah.
You still have to force obedience instead of, you have to, but you don't like it. It really doesn't show that attitude, you know, the proper example. It's not Christ-like. It's
Yeah, there are multiple bad attitudes to have, right? That's a different bad attitude than what Isaiah was talking about. What else? Let's get at least one more example.
Personal favoritism. So that you help who you want to help, and don't help someone that needs it.
Yeah. We see examples of, you know, well, I'm going to help by putting more in the collection plate. Like, oh, you need to go over and go over to this person's house and help us with thus and such. And it's like, what if I just put another $500 in the plate and we hire a company to go and do that for them? Something like that. What's the effect on the church of these different kinds of attitudes?
Not good.
Yeah, that is an awful thing. If we won't reach out to one another, it's funny, the, you know, people will feel like, well, I'm being a burden, right? And to that I say, Jesus literally tells me to bear your burden. If you don't let me do it, you're not letting me obey God. I've heard people say, you know, well, I couldn't make it today, my car broke down. Did everyone's car break down? Did 50 cars break down? Were there 30 people that would gladly have driven to your house? I live further away. We live so far away from each other. Like, seriously, we live. How many counties do we live in? It's ridiculous how far apart we live from each other. Do you think there's any situation where somebody wouldn't, you know, 10 somebodies wouldn't wake up an hour early to go over and get you? Of course they would. These attitudes are cancerous. They're the leaven that leavens the whole lump, right? You see somebody up there and they're like, oh, they don't have enough people. There are too many sick people today, and now I got to do the Lord's Supper table. And like, here's the plate. That's going to have an effect. That's going to have an effect on the worship, but that's also going to have an effect on people's attitude. The person who's always praising themselves, it's just the sickening hypocrisy. You're like, I don't even want to be around this person. I don't want that in my life. Drive people away. The favoritism, people feeling like they're not worthy, they're not as good. They leave, or worse, they try to become a favorite. Ooh, the bad effects that can have. There are some cases where when people do things with the wrong attitude, but the wrong attitude is not outwardly evident, that it's not as impactful on the church. You can think about something like when Paul was talking to the Philippians and he said, some people are preaching because they're emboldened by me being in prison. And some people are preaching because they want my life to be worse in prison. But they're not going around saying that. They're not saying, hey, you should behave like this and behave like a Christian so that Paul's life is worse. They're not saying that. And so Paul's like, well, if they're just preaching the gospel and they think it's going to make my life worse, let them do it. But that wasn't in the church. Those people doing that weren't coming to assembly and leavening the church. I am way far behind. Awareness. We have to be considerate. We have to at all times be considering the people, the situations, the opportunities. You look at Jesus throughout his life, and he would take such a seemingly small thing that was going on and make the absolute most out of it. Well, here's something that doesn't seem like that big of a thing, and he would pause and emphasize it for just a moment because that's what that person needed to hear right then, or because that example would resonate with the group that was around them, or because that would put a false teacher or somebody that was a problem to shame and stop them in that moment. I don't have a lot to say for the rest of the lesson. We only got 3 minutes anyhow. I guess one more. Actions. Under actions, it says you've got physical, emotional, and spiritual needs. I did ask that on Facebook, didn't I? I asked, why are emotional needs the hardest out of those three? Then I asked, or is that just me?
In part, it may be.
It may be.
Because extroverts and emotive people, they're a lot better at it than I am. Being right there when somebody was the very first thing they did, it was just there.
And that may be a leaning on one another kind of thing, right? Maybe somebody can come to you to help them feed the spiritual needs of a brother, and you can go to them to help you feed the emotional needs of a brother.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's difficult because there's more
Yeah, I think that the physical is more obvious what the goal is. Like, you need somewhere to live, you need clothes, you need to eat. Like, I can figure those things out. The spiritual needs, it can get tangled in with the emotional also. It depends. Like, if your emotional needs are something that's hindering you from sharing your weaknesses with one another or from allowing someone to bear your burdens, they do get entered. Tangled. Let's go with Isaiah and then.
The emotional needs are also, as a general statement, more profound and profound by just the world that is around them. Get over kind of attitude, which then leads to, again, brethren not going to come across that way, and also just the fear not being taken seriously.
Yeah, and I think that all of the needs have a sense of embarrassment behind them in a way, and some of that comes back to our society, where our society will deem some things more embarrassing than others, and that seeps into the church. I think that's stereotypically true, and it's on both sides of the equation. It's both on the asking for help part and on the giving, both directions. Anything else before we wrap? All right. Availability was the last one that you've got to make time for it. It's got to be a priority in life to be a servant. If you're like, I'll be a servant 3 hours a week, that ain't going to cut it. Next week, we're going to talk about being strangers and pilgrims.